Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, eviction notices, code violations, and filthy rental units. A new report says the reason for the increase in these problems locally is the transformation of real estate into a Wall Street asset class. We talk to the study's authors. Later, a local filmmaker uncovers the 20 lost springs of North Florida, buried by the nation's largest unfinished public works project. But first, if you've ever looked at a grungy rental property and wondered how it could possibly cost so much, there's a reason. And it's not simply just supply and demand. To tell us what's really happening, we're joined by University of North Florida professor David Jaffe, director of the school's Jax Rental Housing Project. Hey, David.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
And Caitlin Renzi, sociology and political science student at UNF and author of this important study. Hey, Caitlin.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for being here. So, Caitlin, it's hard to focus on just a single takeaway from this report. The findings are really layered. They're really shocking. But I know that you've presented this report at length. What is sort of your elevator pitch?
So I found in my study, which was looking at, you know, ownership of all of these apartments in Jacksonville, 600 in total, that 75% of them were owned by either investment firms or real estate firms. And those firms charge far more money and evict far more people than individual investors, especially local residents. And so it's causing worse conditions for tenants. And then that also is causing sort of slumlords to take this, you know, gap in affordable housing and offer worse conditions for tenants and also evict higher portions of residents. And it creates this relationship between investment firms who extract money from tenants through increasing rents, and this condition with slumlords where they're offering worse conditions but for lower rents. And it really squeezes tenants in between, you know, rock and a hard place.
So your report starts out by saying that more than 40% of Duval County residents are essentially renters, and half of them live in what are called multifamily units.
Right.
So what are multifamily units? Those are basically what we think of as kind of larger apartment complexes?
Multifamily units can be anything from, you know, 2 to 100 plus units. Larger apartment complexes, you're talking 200 to 300 units, but apartment complexes can be as small as, you know, a quad or a duplex.
Mm-hmm. And so you have found that many of these in the Jacksonville area are owned by the same companies, the same global investment firms.
Yes.
But they have this sort of LLC disguise. Explain what that is and how that functions.
Yeah. So a lot of these companies will own, you know, 5-6 properties, and each of them will have separate LLCs. And it makes it really hard for tenants who are living in these properties to know who their real landlord is. You know, they may know their property manager and think that's the owner, but often that's not the case. There's this, you know, far larger LLC that actually owns it. And even if you go and try to find, okay, who is this LLC that owns my property? There may be, you know, several layers of LLC that's trying to block the identity of this ultimate owner.
And that serves what purpose? I mean, It does obscure who owns the property.
Yeah.
How does that serve the companies themselves, the investment companies?
Well, it makes it harder for them to be held accountable. You know, when there are tenants that are like, my rent has gone up, you know, $200-$300 year to year, you know, it's hard to point fingers because the property manager is saying, hey, it's not us, it's the owner. But it's like, how do you know who the owner is?
Mm-hmm. David Jaffe, there's also a relationship that you found and that Caitlin found in this report between LLC ownership and property neglect. Explain to us what that is and why that is.
Yeah, let me just start by talking about the sort of core concept that's been driving what we've been doing. And basically, you know, when we begin to gather data and analyze data on the situation in the rental housing market, the situation for tenants, we've arrived on the concept of the financialization of human shelter. And this lies pretty much at the center of how we understand what's happening to renters. And what that means is that we have in Jacksonville, and it's not exclusively in Jacksonville, this is happening in many other communities, you've got large corporate entities coming in. They're purchasing thousands of single-family homes. They're converting them into rental properties. They're bundling those rental properties into portfolios for their wealthy clients and investors and shareholders. So that's happening in the single family side. The same thing is happening on the multifamily apartment side. So we see over the past 4 years, massive amount of acquisitions of multifamily apartment complexes in Jacksonville. Again, by large corporate firms bundled together and put into portfolios. So that's what we mean by the financialization of human shelter. Human shelter, something that every person needs, is now being financialized as an asset. And the business model that's driving this is largely, once they're acquired, once these properties are acquired, raise the rent, add fees, and essentially cut costs. And cutting costs often means cutting maintenance costs. And this is the business model. And remember that they are promising their investors a certain return on their investment. And often it's somewhere between 10 and 15%. So given that promise, that financial promise, clearly the business model requires them to extract as much income as possible. And so what you have here is, on the one hand, you've got working class people trying to make ends meet, paying high rent on the one end. On the other end, you have investors collecting passive income from their investments. So this is essentially the expanding model of rental housing in Jacksonville, and it's not sustainable. And there simply is no way that we can move toward any kind of affordable housing solution under this system.
So we know that rents are high in Jacksonville. You know, people are advised not to spend more than 30% of their income on rent or mortgage or whatever. More than half the people in Jacksonville, 53%, already spend 30% or more of their income. And almost 30% are spending half of their incomes, more than 50% of their incomes, on rent. They're considered severely cost burdened. But what has changed, you've found, in terms of how these properties are being acquired and by whom? It really has happened in just the last couple of years, right? Since about 2019?
Yeah. A lot of the sales that you see with the multifamily complexes, especially the larger ones, it's since 2019. And some of these properties have been sold 2-3 times since then.
And so the rents very often are increased in that period. We've seen these rents go up quite a bit. And you found that in this city, that people, in order not to be burdened, would have to make $25 an hour, essentially, in order to afford the median rent in Jacksonville. And that's just not what people make here.
That's right. Yeah. So we've also done an analysis of every occupational category in Jacksonville using the information we can get from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And basically, there's about 620 occupational categories. We can take the median hourly wage for each one of those. We can convert that into an annual income, assuming they work 40 hours a week year round. And then we can calculate, you know, what they could afford to keep them below being cost burdened, which is 30% of their income. And what we find is well over 50% of those occupations, based on the median hourly wage, would need to pay, if they wanted to be not cost burdened, they would need to be paying something less than $1,000. And
only, a month in rent.
Yes, in a month in rent. And only about 5%, maybe 5 to 10% of units or apartments in Jacksonville fall into that category. So, and often, you know, when we interview tenants, and we learn a lot through these interviews that we can't pull out of the data. And one of the things we talk to them about is, we say, your cost burden. They say, what does that mean? We say, well, it means that 30% of your income or more is going to rent. And often they laugh at this because they say, I have never, ever not been cost burdened. So the 30% threshold, that is a standard. It's been widely used. Now we have the severely cost burdened at 50%. But the point is, for most tenants, 30% is a dream.
And to be clear, you're saying that about 40% of renters in Jacksonville would need $1,000 or less in rent in order not to be rent burdened, but there's only 5% of the housing, 5% of the available housing is $1,000 or less a month.
Yes, that's right.
So if you're just joining us, we're talking about why Duval is the eviction capital of Florida. If you have a rental story to share, you can join our conversation live on air. You can call 904-549-2937. You can email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can reach out on social media. Caitlin, I want to return to something that you mentioned in terms of the property management companies. Very often people confuse them with the owner. They believe that that's the owner, but they do have a relationship with the owner. Sometimes they manage multiple properties for these large investment companies. Sometimes they're, as you call it, vertically integrated, kind of work for directly. How does that which impact the way that they manage properties and what their incentives are?
Yeah. So with a lot of investment firms, if you've got, you know, an incentive to keep your property management costs lower, you'll want to partner with one property management company. And that way you sort of cut down on, you know, the overall management cost. But sort of the distinguisher that I made between real estate owned apartment complexes and investment firms is that a lot of real estate companies will vertically integrate their property manager within their company, and they will save money on that end. But that's not necessarily being passed on to consumers. They still, real estate owned apartments still have, you know, similar rates as investment firm owned apartments. But it's just a way for these companies to sort of keep some more of that money for themselves.
And when they are incentivized by these companies, I mean, maximizing profits is a big part of that. And so we mentioned fees. That is one way. Rent hikes are another. But another area, another way to kind of increase profits is to reduce what they offer. And how does that play out in real life?
I mean, when a new apartment complex takes over, you know, it can result in slashing amenities. A lot of times, you know, if a new apartment will take over, they may provide cosmetic improvements where they'll maybe repaint the property. But, you know, they're repainting maybe mold, maybe, you know, some other maintenance concerns. So, you know, for that, you know, higher cost of rent, you're really not getting any return on that.
We've got a call from Eugene on the north side. Good morning, Eugene. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. I have a question that's been concerning me about this whole process. Does the city officials up to the mayor and from the city level all the way up to the governor, does any of these folks have a responsibility to curtail this from happening?
Thanks, Eugene. David.
Well, I would hope that they would think they had a responsibility, and maybe there would be some effort to put in place some legislation. But so far, there's really a reluctance for public officials, and remember, we're in Florida, and so there's a political climate here, to intervene in any way that would restrict the ability of private actors to maximize profits. And so I think there's an awareness of this. Often the default explanation, which is insufficient in this case, is that, well, this is just a problem of supply and demand. There's a high demand for housing. There's a shortage of supply. That's all we need to do is supply more housing. And so we've had legislation that tends to focus almost exclusively on the supply side. You have supply side economics that has driven the American economy in trouble, I would say. We also have a supply side approach to understanding this. But unfortunately, just increasing the supply of housing is not going to be sufficient. The question really is who owns the housing and for what purpose? And in most cases, the housing is being owned by large corporate entities, or certainly people are investing in the supply of the housing, anticipating a certain profit. And so privately owned for-profit housing simply is not going to meet the affordable housing needs of the renters. So there was the Live Local Act that was passed statewide. But again, that's largely a supply side driven piece of legislation.
It also contained a rollback of, you know, local government's ability to create any sort of tenant bill of rights. Is that right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, and the same thing happened in 1998 with a statewide preemption on capping rents, on rent controls, especially during affordable housing crises, when other cities, not Jacksonville, but cities like Miami and Tampa were trying to pass laws that would curtail the ability of investors to hike up rents. And this was back in 1998. And then now, more recently, when you saw cities like Tampa and Orlando and Miami trying to pass tenants' bill of rights and sort of more restrictions on things like evictions and more, you know, liability for these owners, the statewide or the state legislature preempted it. And yeah.
Okay. I want to take a call from Mark. Good morning, Mark. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. Your guest mentioned a little while ago about how this is unsustainable, and I get the appeal on the part of investors to invest in something that is not really a stock market, but I'm just curious, do you kind of envision this as a bubble, and at what point will there not be those returns? You know, it'd be kind of like mandating everybody drive a Mercedes, but certainly not every citizen out there can afford a Mercedes. So at some point, you may have that desire, but it is unrealistic and it's unsustainable. So what does that look like when this bubble, for lack of a better word, bursts or passes by? Do you foresee rents coming back down to a more affordable, consumer-driven level?
Good question.
I don't. You rarely see rents actually go down significantly. Now, they might stabilize, and they have recently, but they certainly haven't gone down. I think one of the issues is that some of these investors are overextended in terms of the amount of money they borrowed. That's going to impact in some way their exit, so to speak. Sometimes they use the term profitable disposal to talk about, selling off a piece of property. So there could be some of that, but I don't anticipate that the bubble will be exactly the same. And again, you're talking about renters who need a place to live. So the market doesn't really work the way other kinds of markets do. Renters are going to take pretty much what they can find, and at some point they need stability. And often you have families, you have children, and you just need to have a place that's affordable and safe, affordable relative to what's available in Jacksonville. So I don't anticipate rents going down. It would be good if they were stabilized, but we need an alternative model for affordable housing. This model is not sustainable in a sense that this is the expanding model, and it is driven largely by the acquisition of properties by large corporate entities, and the intent is to extract as much income from those properties. None of these corporate entities, by the way, are producing any housing. They're not building any housing. They're not developing any housing. They are acquiring current properties, multifamily and single family, and using those properties bundled together as a way to extract income, and often income for their investors, their shareholders.
In the report, too, you talked not just about, rents rising, but rents are being set. And in fact, a lot of these companies are using a software to help them set these rates. That's something that's the subject of a federal investigation.
Yeah. There was an investigation, I believe it was an Arizona-based real estate company. I don't think any of the ones that are involved in Jacksonville were brought in that lawsuit. But YieldStar, they have an algorithm that, based on a variety of community factors, how many bedrooms, how many square feet the apartment is, they're able to calculate what the most profitable amount of rent that an apartment can be set for. But in the case like Jacksonville, where probably 50% of overall apartment complexes are using this algorithm, it creates a situation where the algorithm is comparing rents that are set by the algorithm to other apartment complexes that also have rents set by the algorithm. And so it's almost like this, price fixing of this one company that is setting the prices for all of these apartment complexes that are all raising in response to the same apartment complexes.
One of the things that you found, and we alluded to earlier, was how the eviction crisis is particularly acute in Jacksonville, and the numbers bear out almost double the rate of other cities in the state. Tell us what you found in terms of the pace of evictions and what the connection is there in terms of this ownership model.
Well, I mean, Jacksonville is probably the least sympathetic large city, I would say, to tenants compared to other large cities. And so I think that the overall climate certainly has a part to play in it. But a lot of these companies are engaged in almost automatic evictions where their property manager will, sort of almost automatically file these evictions against residents. And there's not really any penalty for them to do so. This is just seen as like part of the profit extraction of them getting their rents. So there's not really any incentive for them not to.
We have a couple of emails I want to get to. Al emailed, just to add another layer to the conversation, if we don't know who the owners are, or who owns the property, can we suspect that some money laundering could be taking place? I don't know that there's any suggestion of that.
I don't know that that's the case. But if they go to the Jack's Rental Housing website, we actually have a document that will tell you who the property manager is, if we know, for your property and every single owner for all apartment complexes with 10 or more units in Jacksonville.
We should say, I mean, Caitlin did, an incredible job of digging through this information using court records, property appraisal records, just searching the web for ownership records. And the document is linked on the First Coast Connect page on our website. You can find it there. And it really is a great resource. It also lists, we should say, this, ranking that you did of essentially the worst performers in the market in terms of, you know, the negative impact that they have by apartment complex and by owner.
Right.
So it's sort of a top 20 of each.
Yes. Yeah. And that's sort of the case is that, yeah, you will see patterns where certain firms that own, you know, 6 or 7 apartment complexes, there's a common trend that a lot of them face high evictions. They also face high building code violations. So there are definitely more so problem tenants that pop out there. Owners, not tenants.
Tom on Facebook said the failure of the city and the state to invest in economic development locally is responsible for much of these evictions. Neighboring communities have been more successful in attracting manufacturing businesses and other job creators. Meanwhile, I've been noting a decline in offered starting wages and job listings in Jacksonville over the last 6 months. We also have a call from Les on the West Side. Good morning, Les. Go ahead.
Good morning. Great show. I just wanted, as a Jacksonville native, we have a couple of rentals. And I just wanted to offer also the cost of insurance has gone up a lot in the last several years. You know, if you carry rental insurance, it's tremendous.
Yeah, that's true. And that has obviously contributed to the overall
cost of housing. That's a good point. We do make a distinction between the corporate landlords and what we call sometimes the mom and pop or amateur landlords. There are individuals that may own, you know, 3 or 4 properties. Perhaps this individual does. That income that they derive from that is income that they live off of. The financialization side is a much different picture. They're bundling hundreds of properties together and extracting income and then distributing that to investors. So just to make that distinction. And, you know, we do talk to tenants and some of them say, you know, I have a great landlord. I know them personally. They only own a few properties. It's an entirely different experience. And often when those people have economic difficulties or challenges, they can talk to the landlord. They can work it out. They have a kind of relationship. This does not exist for the corporate landlords. In most cases, people are interacting with these corporate landlords, the largest ones, through a portal online. That's it. There's not even a property management company office, especially if you have a single family home.
We've got an email from a listener who wanted to remain anonymous saying, I'm in a dispute with my landlord for not replacing a water heater and air conditioning unit that have broken down multiple times. My property manager showed up to my home and told me he got an eviction order. I thought he was bluffing, but it turned out to be true. I was evicted and provided no notice, service of process. I saw the attorney for my landlord in the exact same address as the process serving company. Have you heard of other instances of evictions proceeding without actual service of process or a posting on the front door? It seems like that would be a potential driver behind the eviction rate.
Yes, it happens. This happens routinely because I'm involved with something called the Jack's Tenants Union. We have about 200 members, you know, and also because of the project that I'm working on, the Jack's Rental Housing Project, I get a lot of emails from people who are reporting on these very same issues. And often the problem is that the property neglect has reached a point where some aspect of the living conditions are intolerable, and they're constantly demanding that they be addressed. And often they are viewed as an individual doing this as a nuisance, and they are retaliated against, and often they are pushed out, and they are told that they're going to be evicted. There is a legal way that evictions take place, and people need to be aware of that, because often what might happen is you may be told that an eviction notice has been posted and filed, but in fact it hasn't. So this is used as a strategy by landlords. And again, the rights and protections for tenants in Florida are meager. We're ranked about 42nd among states, if you rank them that way. That's one reason why it's such an attractive place for the corporate investors. They prefer to operate in an environment where the protections are weak and where filing evictions can be easy, almost costless, and proceed rapidly.
Well, I mean, even in addition to evictions, if for instance, someone, their lease is not renewed, or if their rent is raised $300 or $400 a month, it can effectively become an eviction.
Right. And that's what you would call sort of a voluntary eviction, where, you know, residents are displaced and they can't afford to pay the rent. So that's the natural outcome.
We also did get a message on Facebook from Scott, and he's saying a lot of interpreting correlation as causation. What can you tell us about being able to trace one thing to the other, or whether these are just happening simultaneously and not connected in terms of ownership and the problems?
Well, I mean, if you look at, these investment firms' websites, they will tell you straight up that when their primary objective is to extract the most amount of profits for their shareholders as possible. And they do that by extracting more rent through, you know, increased amenities cost, increasing rents overall, decreasing the amount of amenities that are available and sort of leveraging that. So that is an advertised part of the business model.
We have also charted, you know, since 2019, you've seen a sharp rise in rent, right? So we're investigating, like, what's happening, what's different. And there is a fundamentally different, what I would call almost a predatory corporate landlord approach. So, for example, in 2020, I'm talking about single-family homes here, 11% of single-family homes were purchased in Jacksonville by what we'll call an investor of one form or another based on the LLC designation. In 2022, that doubled to 23%. For multifamily apartments during this period, 47% of multifamily properties acquired new owners since 2019. So they're purchasing, they're buying up these properties. 87% of those purchases were by either corporate investment or real estate firms. I think it's a good question, but I think we have documented this pretty well, that this is the singular factor that is driving both rents and the conditions that tenants face in Jacksonville.
And as Caitlin points out, I mean, there are some, and you cite in your report, there are some companies that straight up acknowledge very directly what their business model is. There was a apartment complex in the Arlington area that you found had a lot of problems, was a top evictor, and their webpage describes their business model. It says that they were going to buy the property, quote, then target increased cash flow, lower expenses, and maximized value potential, which is, you know, pretty clearly that they were going to buy a property, increase the rents and fees, and reduce services.
Yeah. I mean, that's the business model. I mean, like, if you're not constructing a new property, the only way to make profit off of an existing property is to raise the rents. So that is what they advertise.
It also helps when you sell it, because there's a lot of short-term-ism here. So they may own it for 5 years. You're obviously going to get more for that property when you finally exit, so to speak, if you can show that you've been able to extract high rents. So the whole system incentivizes this kind of behavior. And the property management companies are hired by the corporate entities. And so that's who they're serving. They're not serving the tenants. They're serving their clients. Their clients are the person who hired them. And that's the large corporate landlord.
And we should say this report is not all gloom and doom. You do have some solutions that you suggest at the end. One, based on the fact that there really is, other than perhaps this report, there really is no good repository to find problematic landlords, problematic properties, no way to effectively report other than sort of call the local news and have them come out and do a story about your rats. But you propose creation of an office at the city level. What would that do? How would that help?
Well, that was actually Jaffe's proposal, but Jaffe, go ahead.
Yeah, well, this was part of the Tenants Bill of Rights that we were trying to get passed in Jacksonville. And as Katie mentioned, there was a Tenants Bill of Rights in the other major cities in Florida. They had been established. The legislature voted for preemption, which meant that no locality could pass an ordinance that in any way regulated the relationship between landlords and tenants. So all those Tenant Bill of Rights that had been passed in those other cities were null and void. There are two provisions in the Tenants Bill of Rights that are still allowable. They're not prohibited, and we're pushing those pretty hard. I work with Florida Rising on this, and one is to establish an Office of Housing Resources, or we originally called it Tenant Advocacy, but some people thought that was too much advocacy for one side, but it's a housing office. And the other is a landlord registry that would be available, publicly searchable, available, that would provide information on the actual owner of every single rental property and all the relevant information you would need if you were going to make a decision about whether you wanted to rent from that landlord.
Well, we will stay abreast if those develop. David Jaffe, Caitlin Renzi, thank you so much for coming on today. And again, Caitlin's report is on the First Coast Connect website if you want to see it. So thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, a filmmaker uncovers hidden springs buried beneath Florida's controversial dam. Welcome back. There are at least 20 freshwater springs hidden beneath the floodwaters of Kirkpatrick Dam in Rodman Reservoir in north central Florida. And Matt Keene, he's an award-winning journalist, he's a filmmaker, and he has made it his mission to help us with him rediscover those lost springs. Matt, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on this morning.
So I want to start because you are quite an adventurer. You're a world record holder for being the first person to complete Florida's 1,515-mile-long saltwater paddling trail. Tell us about what that trail is. What inspired you to take that long, sort of dangerous journey?
Thank you for asking about that. In 2008, I began paddling around the state of Florida. It was 1,515 miles. It followed a newly established paddling trail called the Florida Circumnavigational Saltwater Paddling Trail. I started in September 15th with my now wife and finished January 4th. It was 3 months and 21 days. I've grown up in Florida. I've spent my whole life here, and I grew up just outside of Orlando, and I'd always hear people say, they were from Jacksonville or Tallahassee or Pensacola or the Keys. And having spent my whole life in this state, I really wanted to get an idea for how the state changes, how people live in their hometowns. For me, it was an opportunity to really get a good idea of where I lived and what we needed to protect. I paddled in support of the Florida Paddling Trails Association when I completed that trip.
Paddling is also the way that you found your way into this story of the lost springs. And these are springs, as you say in your film, that are basically trapped under the waters of the Rodman Reservoir, backed up by the Kirkpatrick Dam. And that is the creation of a failed public works project. It was a barge canal that never was.
Yes, that's correct. Yes. So the Cross Florida Barge Canal has been an idea since pretty much the Spanish came over to Florida. We have always been trying to find a quicker route to get across the state of Florida, primarily to move goods from either Mississippi up to New England for national defense reasons, as well as for reasons like hurricanes and that, just to protect cargo. So there was a big push in the 1950s and 1960s to begin what was called the Cross Florida Barge Canal, and construction was begun on two dams, one on the Withlacoochee River on the west side of the state near Inglis, and the other one on the Ocklawaha River. So I had paddled the St. John's River in 2012. I paddled it in its entirety in support of St. John's Riverkeeper, and when I paddled that river, I was really curious about the Ocklawaha. I knew it was the major tributary to the St. John's. I knew it provided a third of the flow to the St. John's. And the Ocklawaha River, its headwaters are actually right near where my hometown was in Claremont and Mineola in Lake County. So I had this natural curiosity about that river. And when we paddled past it on the St. John's, it just disappeared into the tree line. You couldn't even see where the Ocklawaha exited out into the St. John's. And so it really made me want to go and experience it and see how such a powerful river, how a river that could have such an effect on the mighty St. John's could just sort of disappear into the St. John's River. And so in spring of 2013, I paddled the Ocklawaha. And it was an eight-day paddle. It was 81 miles total, including 10 miles, 5 miles up the Silver River and 5 miles back. And when I paddled that, I came up to the Rodman Dam, the Kirkpatrick Dam, which creates the Rodman Impoundment, which is 9,000 acres of floodplain forest that's flooded and 16 miles of river that's flooded by this dam. And I happened to be paddling it with the paddling partner, Ryan Canty, that I was paddling with. We paddled it during the tail end of a drawdown. Now, the dam, in order to, for maintenance purposes, the dam is periodically drawn down, which means the gates to the dam are opened and the river, the water is allowed to release and exit out into the St. John's River.
And that sort of exposes these trapped springs.
Exactly. When the water lowers down, it's dropped from a maintenance level of around 18 feet to about 11 feet. So about 7 feet of water is lowered over this 16 miles. And when it's lowered, it exposes about 20 springs along that route. There are some springs like Cannon Springs and Tobacco Patch Springs that are just absolutely gorgeous springs that after about a month of the water lowering, they just start pouring out this, you know, beautiful crystal clear water, and the flow increases and improves, and the clarity of the springs is just, it's magical to experience. So I paddled it in 2013 and paddled during this drawdown, and as we were getting closer to Rodman Dam, we came through this stretch of about 7 miles that was the drowned forest. And this is an area where, during the construction of the dam, a machine known as the Crusher Crawler came through and basically just plowed a pathway through the national forest and along these lands that were designated for the canal.
I want to ask if people have an opportunity to see this film coming up, where and when?
So the film will be screened June 27th in St. Augustine Beach at Anastasia Island Public Library. That begins at 5:30 p.m. It can also be seen online at lostsprings.org. It can also be seen anytime online at YouTube.
It's a great film. I'm really glad that you made it. I'm really glad that you could come in and talk about it. Appreciate the work that you do, Matt.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Yeah, glad to have you here. Stick around. Up next, we're going to be talking about the first of two Juneteenth celebrations, one connecting churchgoers across racial and class lines. Welcome back. The sounds of jazz, reggaeton, and R&B may not be the sounds you expect to hear inside a cathedral, but this Saturday you will hear all that and more as a new gospel composition makes its Southeast premiere. To tell us about it, I'm joined by Cedric Williams, gospel music director at the St. John's Cathedral. Hi.
Yes. Hi. How are you there?
Glad to have you. We're also joined on the line by Roger Holland, composer and director of the Spirituals Project at the Lamont School of Music at the University of Denver. Good morning, Roger.
Good morning.
So, Roger, let's start with you. You have a background in Broadway. You performed The Color Purple. And yet this is your calling, this spiritual musical creation. Tell us about where this composition came from, what it's called, and what it sounds like.
Sure. Well, I'll start with the name, Voice of My People. It's the second of two published masses of mine by my publisher, GIA Publications. And The Sound of My People was written and published after the Catholic Church issued a new translation of our Book of Prayer, the Roman Missal. And this was about 2010 or so. And so new pieces had new mass settings as well as other liturgical music needed to be composed that incorporated the new translation. So that was the first mass setting, and that one stayed pretty much within a contemporary gospel sphere. But not too long after composing that, I thought about the diversity that exists within the Black Catholic community. Even in my home church of Our Lady of Charity in Brooklyn, we have a wide variety of ethnicities represented, certainly African American there in the heart of Brooklyn, but also a lot of Caribbeans and even some Africans, those from the continent directly. And it seemed important to me that the various cultural voices, even within the African diaspora, needed to be represented within the Catholic liturgy. And so I had been thinking about it for some time as a follow-up mass to that first one. But then within the last couple of years, more intentionally set out to compose this new setting that pulls on various cultural aesthetics and genres that are part of the diaspora within the continent, those of us who are, you know, part of the African diaspora. And so this mass setting explores probably about 6 or 7 different genres, and it's certainly not exhaustive of the cultural musical expressions within the African diaspora, but it employs more than one would typically find in a mass setting.
And run us through some of those musical types.
So I heard you mentioned reggaeton, which is the style. It's actually a hybrid of reggaeton and gospel for the glory to God or the Gloria. But then there's also Afro-Cuban for the gospel acclamation, the Alleluia. For the Holy, 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 or the Sanctus, it is set using African musical idioms, but also the language of Swahili, which is a more universal language, or a language that is more commonly spoken across Africa, amidst probably the hundreds of languages that are spoken.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that, as well as contemporary and traditional gospel. But many African Americans also compose, enjoy, and sing music composed within the Western classical idiom. And so the opening and closing movements, the Kyrie and the Agnus Dei, respectively, in the Greek and Latin, are set in a more classical style. The opening movement, the Kyrie, is composed and accompanied, set with an organ accompaniment.
Roger, I'm just going to interrupt you for a second if I can, because I want to make sure I can bring in Cedric to talk a little bit about the event that's coming up.
Sure.
In the time that we have. This is a June 15th event. It's at St. John's Cathedral, but it's an Episcopal church.
Yes, it is.
And so this is a mass that is everybody welcome, or is it specifically for
everybody
Catholics?
Is welcome. Yes, absolutely.
Okay. And so tell us what the connection is with Juneteenth for this performance.
Was a little bit of history behind it. This kind of evolved from the UBE event that takes place on a variety of UBE events. They generally celebrate MLK and also Absalom Jones, and we had both of those events at St. John's. And from that last event, at the Absalom Jones event, I connected with the dean in the courtyard.
And we
talked
say
about
UBE is the Union
of Black Episcopalians.
Okay.
And I was chatting with her about, I realized that the Juneteenth holiday was coming up, and I asked her, I said, is there a possibility, do you have something going on for Juneteenth? And she said, no. I said, I have a piece in mind that would work. I mentioned the St. Cyprian Mass, and she said, yes, let's go. And we met, we put it all together. And from there, we have been regularly returning to do an event.
Well, it's exciting that it's coming up this weekend. I'm sure it'll be a glorious performance. Thank you so much, Roger Holland and Cedric Williams, for being here today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Sure.
Up next, musicians, dancers, and pop-ups make a love connection along the Riverwalk.
LifeSouth Community Blood Centers, providing blood and patient services to the local hospitals, serving patients in this community. Donating blood with LifeSouth helps save lives. More at LifeSouth.org to find a blood drive near you.
North Florida TPO, proud sponsor of WJCT's First Coast Connect, bringing to the community innovation in transportation planning, commuter services, clean fuels, and intelligent transportation systems. More at NorthFloridaTPO.com.
Despite how it may feel, there actually is meaningful work getting done in Washington.
You actually see a whole bunch of areas where a meaningful number of Democrats and Republicans have not only agreed, but agreed in a way that have allowed policies to be implemented.
Renewed bipartisanship in the nation's capital. That's next time on Think. Tonight at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Sumo wrestling is off limits to women in Japan, but they can get into the ring at international sumo events.
Then what I do, I'm exuding some kind of aura that I'm going to fight. And afterwards, my opponent will say that you looked bigger in the ring.
Now Japanese women sumo wrestlers want to compete in their home country. That's next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
President Biden takes action on the border.
To protect America as a land that welcomes immigrants, we must first secure the border and secure it now.
What the Biden administration is doing by restricting asylum, who's affected, and how it plays into the president's political calculus. That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
It's funny that you roll in my face. We got growth in abundance, learning more.
Let's go.
Every day.
Let's go. Let's go.
Welcome back. We're listening to a little Love Culture there. The Duval-based hip hop collective is organizing a different kind of Juneteenth celebration, and here to tell us about it, Flash the Samurai and Easy in 2D, artists and performers with Love Culture. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks, Anne. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, and Sherls, dancer and executive director of the local dance platform In the Midst. Welcome, Sherls.
Thank you.
So Love Culture has become more than a band. It's a bit of a local movement. But for people who aren't familiar, describe how it came together and a little bit about the kind of music that you make.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, we came together as we were all solo artists. We came together doing a show put on by friends of ours, namely Rob Murray. That's part of Love Culture, Kyle Durrell, Wade Taylor. So we did a show and then we came together kind of like, hey, man, we like each other's vibe. Let's do more work. And then it kind of grew from there into what you see now. That's kind of the short version of it. But we just fell in love with each other's vibe. And it's not typical in this city, mm-hmm. you know. So it was just, let's connect. Let's do something bigger than just ourselves as solo artists, essentially.
And Flash, how do you describe that vibe? Like, how do you describe the connection that you have and the product that you make?
For me personally, it's just so natural. You know, it's almost like you don't choose your family. You know, it's like a natural connection that you guys already have. So with us, the music was just the natural connection. And then you get to know these people and then you get to be around them a lot more. And, you know, you get to put together something so cohesive with the chemistry that you build with these people. And it's almost undeniable at that point.
This is kind of progressive hip hop, though. Mm-hmm. It's harmonious. It's mm-hmm. Intelligent. It's a very, you know, thoughtful.
Yeah, absolutely.
But very funky.
Thank you. Yeah, we appreciate it.
That's the goal.
Yeah.
So, Sherls, tell us about Love Fest. What is that? What's the connection with the Juneteenth holiday, and what can people expect?
Yeah, so Love Fest will be the second annual Love Fest, and it's basically what Love Culture puts together. They wanted it to be for the community. They do a lot of big performances, but this is something that they wanted to give back, more so like a love letter to Jacksonville. You're going to be able to experience different vendors. You're going to be able to experience different performers. We've got a great lineup of performers, food trucks, DJs. We've got a slew of things, dancers for sure. Mm-hmm. But just a different genre of everything in the culture here in Jacksonville, the arts.
And so it's on the Riverwalk.
Yes.
Also inside the Winston Y, is that
yes.
right?
Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah. So what's the layout? What, and is it a free event? Is it a paid event?
It is a free event. Yeah. So it's open to anybody, all ages, all genres. And it's right along the Riverwalk. So starting from the Y and all the way down, all the way till you get to like FIS.
Mm-hmm. And so you're a dancer.
Yes.
There'll be a dance element. What are you going to be personally performing?
Or? Oh, yes. Yes. So In the Midst is a platform that is for the dance community. So you're going to be able to experience solo performances. You're going to be able to experience a 15-minute production pretty much put on by local dancers here in the community.
Excellent. And is there a theme to the event other than kind of love, a love letter to Jacksonville?
So the dance theme is going to be like a summer love, summer 2000s. We're trying to bring it back old school.
Mm-hmm. And what was the inspiration and the purpose behind like the name In the Midst? And the platform itself.
So In the Midst was found by Rochelle Underdew about 8 years ago. And she basically wanted to create a platform that was displaying who she's in the midst of. So she's a platform that came from Jacksonville. She went to LA. And then when she came back, she wanted to just showcase herself as who she's in the midst of in Jacksonville and throughout her whole experience.
What kind of dance?
She is more a hip hop based street dancer, but she's in the midst of a bunch of different dancers. So you're going to see out there on Friday, you're going to see contemporary, you're going to see some crump, you're going to see street dance, you're going to see whacking, vogue, house, hip hop, just a whole genre. The Jacksonville dance community is enriched with a lot of different genres.
Yeah,
so
100%.
That's excellent. And for Love Culture, you're going to be one of the performers. What are you planning? And you've got some friends that are going to be coming and performing.
Absolutely.
Before and after.
Yeah. So we have, before us, we have, well, I mean, there's two separate stages.
Okay.
We want to make sure that we're able to have the people move from one stage to the other, so everyone gets their proper, like, you know, viewing, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so we want to be able to move the crowd between vendors, between activities, between the Y. The Y has a wellness center. But a little bit more about the performers. We do have Jawberry, Intricate, The Almighty, and Ebonique, which is no stranger to the show here.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be beautiful to just see these people, because we've seen these people, we've rehearsed with these people before, but people putting us on a platform put us where we are, and for us to have a platform to put people on is just, it's us giving back.
Mm-hmm.
So, definitely.
What are you most looking forward to?
Man, that's all that, to be honest. We love performing. We love connecting with people. But for us, like, a big thing for us was, again, highlighting the city, highlighting the talent in the community. And again, not just with artists, but the dance community, the art community as well, too. And again, really just bring it together in a melting pot. So again, the city, sometimes, like you said, some of this stuff might get pushed down in the radar. Obviously, there's the mainstream things as well. But like you mentioned, us kind of being a different kind of vibe that the city may not be used to. I'm looking forward to seeing all the people coming out and seeing that, wow, the city has all this to offer.
We're going to hear a little Ebonique now as we close, but the event is June 14th. Where can people get tickets, just briefly?
You can actually show up at this point.
All right.
Yeah, just show up.
All right. Yeah, dynamite. Well, thank you, Flash the Samurai, Easy and 2D, and Sherrills. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
All right. That's our program. You can join us tomorrow. We're going to talk about the growing community controversy surrounding a proposed bioethanol plant in Fernandina Beach. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.